The money kept moving even when it should have stopped. Loans stacked on loans, collateral pledged, then pledged again, then quietly reused somewhere else. On paper, everything looked alive. Clubs were bought, logos were unveiled, executives smiled beside famous teams. Behind the scenes, lenders started asking the same question at the same time. Who else was promised this asset? Investigators say the answer was everyone. Federal prosecutors allege that the founder of a fast-growing investment firm raised more than $500 million by hiding risk, recycling collateral, and feeding lenders assurances that were not true. The firm's public image rested on prestige and access. Its private reality, according to the charges, rested on a shell game that only worked as long as new money kept coming in. When the math finally broke, the story stopped being about sports ownership. It became about intent, about documents, about whether the collapse was mismanagement or something far worse. Chapter 1. The money looked real. The pitch landed clean. An alternative investment firm with global reach, private credit, insurance backing, sports teams as proof of access and credibility. To lenders, it looked modern and aggressive, the kind of operation that moved fast because it knew where the exits were. The firm was called 777 Partners. It presented itself as disciplined and data-driven. Executives spoke about diversification and risk controls. They talked about structured finance, not speculation. They said the money was protected. Behind closed doors, the message was sharper. The firm needed capital to keep expanding. Loans would be short-term, collateral would be clean, returns would arrive on schedule. Every deal came with documents, charts, and assurances that the assets backing the loans were solid and isolated. Lenders listened. The firm's rise was loud and visible. Stakes in football clubs across Europe and South America, high-profile sponsorships, public appearances that suggested permanence. Each acquisition reinforced the same signal. This was not a paper operation. This was real money buying real assets. That visibility mattered. It reassured lenders who were not inside the firm's books. Team ownership was not just an investment strategy. It was proof of life, proof that capital existed and that it moved when asked. Internally, the operation ran on speed. Loans were raised quickly and deployed just as fast. New vehicles were created to hold assets. Old obligations were rolled forward. The firm's leadership spoke in terms of momentum. Growth covered mistakes. Expansion masked stress. At first, the system worked. Money flowed in from lenders who believed their loans were secured by specific assets. Insurance receivables, investment positions, contractual cash flows. Each loan came with a story about where the collateral lived and how it could be accessed if things went wrong. What lenders did not see was the full picture. They saw their slice, not the whole pie. Documents showed collateral assigned to a loan. But those documents did not always show whether the same asset had been referenced elsewhere. The firm controlled the information flow. It decided which pieces each lender saw. As long as payments arrived on time, questions stayed quiet. Problems began when lenders started comparing notes. One asked about a delayed payment. Another asked for updated collateral schedules. A third noticed language in a document that felt recycled. The same phrases, the same asset descriptions, the same comfort language. Inside the firm, pressure rose. Cash demands increased as obligations stacked up, sports teams required funding, operational costs grew, loan repayments came due faster than new capital could be raised. The solution, prosecutors would later allege, was not transparency, it was reuse. Collateral that had already been pledged was quietly referenced again. Assets were shifted between entities on paper. Risk was diluted across structures so no single lender could see how thin the margin had become. To the outside world, nothing looked wrong. The firm continued to announce deals. Executives spoke confidently. Payments continued, though sometimes late. But inside the loan stack, the math tightened. Lenders asked for clarity. They wanted confirmations. They wanted to know where their security sat in the capital structure. Responses came back polished and reassuring. Delays were blamed on administrative issues. Complexity was framed as sophistication. Some lenders accepted that explanation, others did not. The first cracks appeared in emails, requests that went unanswered, follow-ups that produced partial responses, collateral schedules that changed without explanation. One lender noticed that an asset described as exclusive in their loan agreement appeared in a separate deal summary circulated months later. Another realized that liquidation rights were not as clean as promised. These were not public revelations. They happened quietly, behind conference calls and legal language, but once they started, they did not stop. The firm's leadership continued to project confidence. They pointed to the value of the sports teams. They pointed to future inflows. They insisted that temporary liquidity issues were being resolved. Investigators would later say that the structure depended on that confidence. The system only survived if lenders believed their risk was contained. If too many demanded enforcement at once, the entire structure would collapse. At this stage, no criminal charges existed. There were no public allegations of fraud. What existed was a widening gap between what lenders thought they owned and what actually backed their loans. Internally, that gap became harder to manage. Cash that should have gone to repayments was redirected to keep operations afloat. New loans were raised to cover old ones. Collateral descriptions grew more abstract. Language replaced specificity. The firm's public image continued to grow. Ownership stakes in clubs were celebrated. Executives appeared alongside athletes and officials. To outsiders, it looked like a firm hitting its stride. To lenders inside the stack, it felt different. They saw delays. They saw complexity increasing instead of decreasing. They saw explanations that did not quite answer the question being asked. The question was simple. If everything was secure, why did enforcement feel so difficult? As months passed, some lenders began preparing for legal action. Not because they had proof of fraud, but because they no longer trusted the answers they were receiving. They hired counsel. They reviewed documents. They traced asset paths. What they found raised alarms. Assets were intertwined across entities. Collateral assignments overlapped. Security interests competed with one another. The clean isolation promised at the start did not exist. This was the moment when confidence shifted to suspicion. Still, the firm did not stop operating. It continued to negotiate, it continued to seek capital, it continued to present itself as solvent and stable. From the outside, the money still looked real. But underneath, the structure was thinning. Every new obligation reduced the margin for error. Every reused asset increased the risk that enforcement would expose the whole system. Lenders were no longer asking about returns, they were asking about survival. And for the first time, the question was not whether the firm could grow. It was whether it could unwind without collapsing everything it had built. Chapter 2, Recycling the Same Dollar. By the time lenders realized something was wrong, the structure was already under strain. What looked like separate loans tied to separate assets began to resemble a single pile of obligations balanced on the same narrow base. According to later filings, the same collateral appeared again and again, described slightly differently each time. An insurance receivable in one deal, a secured position in another, a protected cash flow somewhere else. On paper, each lender believed they held priority over a defined asset. In reality, those priorities overlapped. The firm controlled the map. It decided which version of the truth each counterparty received. As liquidity tightened, internal movement increased. Assets were shifted between affiliated entities. Loan proceeds were routed through layered structures. The complexity was not accidental. It made tracking exposure difficult, even for sophisticated lenders. Payments still went out, but they arrived unevenly. One lender was paid on time, another waited weeks, a third received partial amounts with promises to settle the balance shortly. Each delay was explained as temporary. Inside the firm, pressure mounted. Obligations multiplied faster than capital. Sports clubs required ongoing funding. Operational costs did not pause for restructuring. Loan covenants loomed. Prosecutors would later allege that this was the point where concealment replaced optimism. Risk was no longer misunderstood, it was hidden. Lenders asking for clarity were met with controlled disclosures. Collateral schedules were provided, but without full context. Legal language emphasized security while avoiding detail. Questions about exclusivity were answered narrowly. Some lenders pushed harder. They requested confirmations from third parties. They asked to verify assets directly. Those requests slowed the process. Responses became defensive. Behind the scenes, the firm sought fresh capital to keep the system moving. New loans were raised not to expand, but to service existing commitments. Old promises were sustained with new money. The structure resembled a relay. Cash entered, moved quickly, and exited just as fast. There was no room for interruption. Any pause risked exposure. That exposure came when lenders compared notes. Two parties discovered they had been shown the same asset as security. Another found that liquidation rights were subject to conditions that had not been disclosed. Timelines did not match. Valuations shifted. The realization spread quietly. This was not isolated confusion. It was systemic. Civil complaints followed. Lenders accused the firm of misrepresentation, concealment, and fraud. They alleged that collateral had been recycled and that risk had been deliberately obscured to induce lending. The firm denied wrongdoing. It framed the disputes as misunderstandings driven by complexity and market conditions. It argued that asset values remained strong and that issues could be resolved through negotiation. But trust was gone. As lawsuits progressed, documents entered the public record, loan agreements, internal communications, collateral schedules that contradicted one another. What had been invisible became traceable. The picture that emerged was not one of a single bad deal, but of a pattern. The same assets referenced across multiple obligations, the same assurances repeated even as exposure grew. Investigators began to examine intent. They focused on timing. When did the firm know liquidity was insufficient? When did it continue to raise funds anyway? When were assurances given that could no longer be supported by reality? This distinction mattered. Poor management could explain losses. Deliberate concealment suggested something else. As scrutiny intensified, counterparties moved to protect themselves. Enforcement actions were considered. Demands for repayment increased. Negotiations stalled. The system that relied on confidence now faced coordinated pressure. Internally, options narrowed. Selling assets quickly risked revealing the extent of overlap. Allowing defaults risked triggering cross-claims. Transparency threatened collapse. The firm continued to operate, but its room to maneuver shrank. Every move was watched, every representation questioned. Sports clubs that once symbolized legitimacy now became liabilities. Their funding needs clashed with creditor demands. Their visibility drew attention rather than comfort. The narrative shifted. What had been framed as aggressive growth now looked like overextension. What had been called sophistication now resembled obfuscation. Regulators and prosecutors took notice. They reviewed the civil complaints. They analyzed transaction flows. They traced collateral assignments. The question was no longer whether lenders had been misled. It was whether the misdirection had been intentional. As evidence accumulated, the firm's explanations lost force. Complexity could not explain duplicated collateral. Administrative error could not explain repeated assurances contradicted by documents. The structure depended on isolation. Once that illusion broke, the math became impossible to ignore. By the end of this phase, the firm was no longer controlling the narrative. Lenders, courts, and investigators were defining it instead. What had begun as a private credit dispute was now something larger. The system had not collapsed yet, but it was exposed. And once exposed, it could not be put back together the way it had been before. Chapter 3. When the math broke, the shift from civil dispute to criminal case did not happen all at once. It arrived in pieces. Subpoenas, requests for records, interviews that moved from cooperative to careful. What lenders had alleged in lawsuits, prosecutors now examined for intent. The central claim was no longer confusion. It was deception. According to charging documents, investigators concluded that more than $500 million had been raised through representations that concealed the true condition of the firm. Collateral was not just misunderstood. It was allegedly reused while being presented as exclusive. Risk was not merely complex. It was hidden. Prosecutors described a pattern. Loans raised after liquidity problems were already apparent. Assurances given, even as internal documents showed mounting exposure. Assets shifted to create the appearance of coverage where little remained. The firm's public posture held until it could not. Once criminal charges were filed, negotiations ended. The language changed. What had been framed as business disagreement became an alleged fraud scheme. For lenders, the filing confirmed what they feared. The protections they believed they held were compromised. Enforcement would not be clean. Recoveries would be uncertain. For the firm, the charges froze everything. Access to capital vanished. Counterparties withdrew. Employees faced sudden instability. Sports clubs tied to the firm were forced to plan for life without expected funding. The cases ran in parallel. Civil actions continued while criminal proceedings advanced. Each new filing revealed more detail, overlapping collateral, contradictory representations, internal timelines that undermined public statements. The government emphasized sequence, what the firm knew, when it knew it, what it said anyway. That sequencing mattered. It separated collapse from conduct. Defense arguments pointed to market conditions and complexity. They argued that asset values fluctuated and that structures were misunderstood by outsiders. They denied intent to defraud. Prosecutors countered with documents, emails, loan schedules, statements that showed confidence long after liquidity had evaporated. The illusion that had sustained the structure could not survive scrutiny. The math was now public, the overlap undeniable. Sports ownership, once the firm's strongest signal of legitimacy, became a symbol of overreach. Teams found themselves entangled in legal uncertainty. Fans and regulators questioned how ownership standards had allowed such structures to pass. The fallout spread beyond one firm. Private credit lenders reviewed their own exposure. Sports leagues examined ownership vetting. Regulators revisited oversight gaps. The case raised a broader question. How much of modern finance depended on trust layered over opacity? How often complexity was mistaken for protection? For those inside the firm, the reckoning was immediate. Assets were frozen, transactions halted, the momentum that once defined the operation reversed into inertia. Employees who had believed in growth faced reputational damage. Partners distanced themselves. Silence replaced confidence. For lenders, recovery became the focus, not profits, not returns, survival. They assessed what could be reclaimed and what was gone. The criminal charges did not resolve those questions. They framed them. The final outcome remained uncertain. Courts would decide guilt. Asset recoveries would take years. Some losses would never be recovered. But the structure itself was finished. What had relied on recycled assurances could not survive exposure. Once lenders saw the full map, there was no incentive to keep the system alive. The case left a mark on private credit, on sports ownership, on the idea that visibility equaled safety. The lesson was not subtle. Assets do not multiply because they are described differently. Collateral does not strengthen because it is reused. Confidence does not replace capital. When the math broke, it did so quietly at first, then all at once. And in the end, what remained was not a question of growth or ambition, but of cost. Who paid it? Who avoided it? And how long the warning signs had been ignored before the collapse became impossible to deny.